Hi, this is Chaz Palminteri, and welcome to the Chaz Palminteri Podcast. I've gotten a lot of emails about what are my favorite movies, movies that inspired me. Well, I can give you a few. I think these are the movies that you should see, whether you're an actor, writer, director, producer. The first one is On the Waterfront with Marlon Brando. That's my favorite movie of all time. In fact, it's Marty Scorsese's favorite movie. And a lot of people I know, it's their favorite movie. It's the perfect movie, perfectly acted, casted, directed, Elie Kazan. I cannot say enough about it. It's a movie that you should see. It'll inspire you. Another great film you should see, Casablanca. Now, when you watch Casablanca, is it a little dated? Yes. But look at the script. There's not a wasted word in the whole script. Watch that movie. You just can't believe it. There's not one word was wasted. 12 Angry Men, another one of my favorite movies. Especially if you're a director. Watch that movie and watch where the camera moves and how the whole movie is done in a room, really, in a jury room. And it's still riveting because of the script and the camera work and the actors. Well, 12 Angry Men is about the innocence or the guilty of this young man. And they don't know. And the way it approaches it, 11 say he's guilty. One man, Henry Fonda, says, well, let's talk about this a little. And through the whole movie, Henry Fonda, that one man who said that he's not guilty, convinces everyone that we don't have absolute proof to send this boy to jail for the rest of his life. It's just a great movie. Mean Streets by Marty Scorsese. Now, obviously, Marty has done so many great movies, but I always go back to Mean Streets because I just love that film because it was so raw and real and honest. And if you look at it today, it still holds up about this character, Johnny Boy, that De Niro played, and Charlie, played by Harvey Keitel. It's Shakespearean. It's a wonderful film. You know, Steven Spielberg used to say, the way he learned to really direct was he watched movies with the sound off, everything off. And that's a really good way to do it. Because when I've directed movies, I started doing that. And I started watching movies with the sound off. And I just watched the camera work. A Touch of Evil by Orson Welles. Just shut the sound off and watch that movie. Wow. I mean, the camera work on it is just fantastic. So let's talk about some advice for writers. We'll get into the acting and directing and a whole bunch of stuff, but let's talk about writing. What makes writing so hard? As I always spoke about, in writing, you have to do it. Nobody forces you to get up there, sit at a desk, and start to write. Like I said before in another episode, acting is easy. It's not easy, but you're forced to do it. You have to learn the lines. You'll get fired if you don't. You have to be there at 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, whatever. Directing, you have to do it. Writing, that's the hardest because you got to be there on your own. And some tips that I could give you for your writing is you must look at it like you're going to a job. You have to write. You could write 5 days a week if you want. Take 2 days off. That's fine. And those 2 days, you can make notes and think about what you're going to write. And one tip that I got from a great writer, Arthur Miller, obviously one of the greats, he told me that a lot of times what he would do is when he would write and then come to a great idea after about 4 or 5 hours, he would stop. And I would say, why would you stop when you got a great idea? And he said to me, because, Chaz, you're excited to get up the next day and start to write it. Because if you write for 14 hours straight and you burn yourself out, the next day you get up and you stare at a blank piece of paper. So write for 4 hours. 4 hours is a good time, 5 hours. And then when you come up with a great scene that you want to write about, stop. So you know, you think about it at night, think about it in the morning. You wake up, you go to the computer, and you're all excited. And I have to say, that was a great tip. And I do that. Writing is to write. People come over to me and they say, Chaz, you know, I'm an amateur writer. You're a professional, but maybe you can give me some advice. And I say, no. Hold on. Wait a minute. We're all the same. If you're a writer, you're a writer. They said, come on, Chaz. I said, no. Here's the difference. An amateur writes garbage and gets demoralized and stops. A professional writes garbage and keeps on going. That's the difference. That's the only difference, you see. You have to write your way through garbage sometimes. Not everything you write is going to be great. Sometimes you're going to look at it the next day and say, oh man, look at this. I don't like this at all. So you rewrite it. Writing is rewriting. It's constantly rewriting. You think anybody writes a script and then hands it over and says, okay, go make the movie? That never happens. Never. Never. The problem is sometimes you have to write what's inside of you, what you feel. If you're writing about something you don't know about, then you better do your research. Research it as much as you can. You think these people who write books and screenplays, when they write about World War II and World War I or suicide or mass murders, they don't do research? You have to do your research. Now, could you write about yourself and your experiences, which I have? But you have to remember, this is what I learned a long time ago as a writer, that when you're writing about things you know, incidences that happen to you, you start going shorthand. Like, you start writing thinking, oh, they know this, oh, they know that. No, they don't know that. You know it because you're writing it. But you have to convey it to us and explain it to us what you're feeling. Why is this character acting like that? You know, many times I'll read screenplays, and it's hard to write a screenplay. Please believe me, it's very hard. I think a screenplay is harder to write than a book, maybe even a play. I don't know. I'm not sure about that. But the thing about a screenplay is one page is 1 minute. So think about if you write 2 pages of boring shit, you want to count how long 2 minutes goes? If I sit here now for 2 minutes without saying a word, that's forever. Forever. So that's why in a screenplay, every page is important of what you're writing about. There's a lot of wasted space, a lot of wasting. People write and they write pedestrian. Well, he met and this happened and that happened. It's the story. It's the story that counts. And I say, sometimes in a person said to me once, I was teaching a writing class at a college, and a person said to me, Mr. Palmateri, how do I be creative? How can I write? I said, look, they think there's a magic formula. I said, I could teach you some techniques, but I can't teach you how to be creative. That's on you. Now, here's the essence of every screenplay. The essence of every screenplay. You get the main character up a tree. That's the first act. The second act, you get him higher up the tree. The third act, you get him down. That's it. I know that sounds easy, but if you look at it, I could bring up a Bronx Tale, since I know it so well. The first act, the first 30 pages, we get the character up a tree. 1968, we go right up to 1968. The boy's getting wooed by the gangster more and more. His father keeps saying, don't do it, don't do it. Boom. By the second act, there he is at the racetrack with Sonny. Now we got him farther up the tree in the second act. And don't forget, the second act is always the hardest to write in a screenplay. People say, why is that? because it's the most time you have. The first act is usually 30 pages, the first 30 pages. Second act is 60 pages, double that. So you have to find and get that character higher up a tree, in the highest danger he could be, or whatever. But something has to happen in that second act. Most screenplays I read have terrible second acts. They know how to start the movie, they know how to end the movie, but they don't know what to do in the middle. That's the hardest act. And I could say to you is get the character farther up the tree. In the third act, the last 20 or 30 pages, you get him down somehow.
How many scripts do you read or plays you read where you get the first act and then the second act you would go, nothing's happening here?
Most of them.
Just because something is going on doesn't mean something is happening.
Right. You're absolutely right, Dante. My son brought up a very good point. And I'll read some scripts and he'll go, how's the script? I go, wow, it started off like a house of fire, so I'm excited. And then all of a sudden, it just gets, nothing happens. Nothing happens. And it's like, it's so disappointing. But usually I could tell. I could tell someone who could really write in the first 15 pages. Am I fooled? Sometimes, yes, but not often. You could hear if they have a voice, if they got something to say. A dead giveaway to a bad script. That's a good question, Michael. I would say a dead giveaway to a bad script is someone who tells me it's a great script. Everybody tells me their script is great. Am I right, guys? Am I right? Everybody. When they give me the script, they say, this, my God, Chaz, I can't wait to read it. It's a great script. I go, okay, that's a dead giveaway. Because most of the time, it's not a great script.
Tell them about the guy who came to the door.
Yeah, there was that's a funny story.
He had a great script.
My son brought up this one guy. One time I was here alone. I happened to be home alone. I was home alone. And I get somebody buzzes the gate outside by the road because you can't come into my property. It's all gated off. And I said, who is it? And he said, delivery from Gino's. I said, Gino's? He goes, yeah, Gino's Pastry in the Bronx. Now, Gino's Pastry in the Bronx, everybody knows that I go there. It's the greatest pastry in the world, the greatest cannolis and greatest cakes and cappuccinos, and it's fantastic. So I say, oh, all right. So I buzz him in. So I see this car come down that I don't recognize, and he goes, this is from Jerome from Gino's. And he gives me the box, and I say, oh, okay. I thought maybe Jerome just sent me some pastries. So, and the guy, as I'm walking away, looks at me and goes, oh, and there's a script underneath the pastries. I said, what? I said, Gino sent me a script? He said, no, it's my script. I put it underneath the pastries. I want you to read it. It's a great script. I said, excuse me, this is your script? Gino's had nothing to do with this? He goes, no, I just know that you like Gino's pastries, and I thought maybe I could get in to see you. Do you imagine this? Says this to me, guys. So I say to him, hold on one second. I'll be right back. I walk into my house. I cut the cord. I take the pastry out. I take the script out. And I walk back outside, and I give him the script. I said, here's the script. I said, excuse me. I said, here's your script. I'm keeping the pastry. I felt like the Godfather, you know, leave the gun, take the cannolis, you know, that's what I felt like. This is a true story. So he looks at me and says, hey, I said, hey, man, I said, you don't come into a man's home like that. You don't trespass like that. I said, what about if my wife was here by herself and you told her that? You would have scared the hell out of her. My children are here. I said, what kind of person are you? He goes, oh, I'm a lawyer. He went about it all the wrong way, man. I understand people out there that are desperate. They want people to read it. But that's not the way to do it. That's not to invade a man's home. And he said, well, you know, you could be, he said, look, I can make you rich. And I said, hey, stupid, look around. I'm already rich. You know, which was kind of an asshole thing to say, but I had to say it just to shut him up. you know, and he left. So I know you want people to read your script. I do. But the best way to do it is maybe you could send a person an email. You could send them an email. You could send, try with his agent first. Or if you meet him at a party, at a premiere, you say, Mr. Palminteri, I'm sorry to bother you, but I have this script here. And I would say, look, send it to my agent and let them read it. And if it's really good, you could send it to me. Or there are times I make them send it to my development people, but they have to sign an agreement that they will never sue me because I don't know what they're sending me. I could have something in my development that might be very similar to what they're sending me. So I want them to be very clear with that. I mean, that's real important. I know people are desperate. They're actors and writers and directors, and they want to be seen, but you got to do it the right way. You can't, like, overdo it. I mean, look, did I know this was all going to happen to me? I mean, kind of way I did, in a way, because I really believed in myself. I think that when you write I'm glad you're taking the questions that I've gotten. One of the questions was, how do you write a strong first act? Well, you want to grab the people right away. You want to say, hey, I want to read this. The way you write something, I mean, you know, I did a couple of plays with Jerry Zaks, the director. And Jerry Zaks is just brilliant. And I said to him once, I said, Jerry, what makes a great script to you? And this is him. This is not my words. And he said to me, Chaz, when I turn the page, I want to turn the next page. He says, it's the constant learning of new events. And I never forgot that. I thought that was just brilliant what he said to me. And when I always write, I think about that. Am I writing, and am I getting very pedestrian here, just talking about, hey, give me the food, give me, what? How does this pertain to the story? How does this pertain to the story? That's the most important thing. I overwrite. And it's okay to overwrite. Don't worry about overwriting. Because then when you look at it, you say, oh, I have to cut down and get to the spine of the story. I'm a notorious cutter after I write the first draft. I start going, does this pertain to the story? Does this move the story? Does this make you want to listen? No. Out. 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 And sometimes you'll write a great monologue and a great scene, and you love it. Love it. But you know what? It's got to go. It's got to go because it doesn't work. I directed a movie called Noel. And this was a movie, it was a Christmas movie, a terrific movie, with Susan Sarandon, Robin Williams, God bless him, God bless his soul, Paul Walker, God bless his soul, Penelope Cruz, Alan Arkin, wonderful actors. You always got to get the best actors. And I directed it, and I'm looking at the final cut, and there was something about the scene that I just couldn't get. It just went on too long. I didn't know what to do, but I knew I needed the scene. So I couldn't cut it because I needed that scene. And I had one of my friends come and look at it for me. He was a director and an actor, and his name was Mars Callahan. Wonderful. He wrote Pujol Junkies and directed that with me. And Mars saw it and he said, oh, Yeah. He just looked at it and said, yeah, you just got to cut the scene in half. End it right here. And I went, what? Are you out of your mind? I can't end the scene there. And I was going on and on. He said, no, you'll get the whole story right there. Now, when you bring in fresh eyes to look at a script or a movie or your book, it's different. You're so used to seeing it, you're not even judging it anymore. You just assume that it has to be there. So you bring in fresh eyes, and they look at it, and they go, oh, no. And I said, no, I disagree. I totally disagree. So he left. And I was talking to the editor, and I said, no, he's crazy, right? And he said, well, I agree with you, Chaz, but why don't we just try it? And I said, you're right. Let's just try it. And we tried it. And we looked at it. And I went, let's play it again. And we looked at it again. Because our eyes weren't used to that. Our ears weren't used to hearing it like that, you see. And then I looked at it and I said, son of a bitch, he's right. He's right. And I left it that way in the movie. And I tell you something, and I tell this to all the artists out there, or anybody out there who's involved in creativity, that I learned from Bob De Niro, and I learned from a lot of other people, that it takes just as much talent to recognize a great idea as it is to come up with it yourself. Don't go, oh my God, he gave me this great idea and I can't use it because that shows that I'm not talented. That's bullshit. If you hear a great idea or a great note, you use it. That's creativity. Because 10 people can give me an idea, right? But if I take number four's idea, who's number four, I take his idea, I have the same amount of talent because I recognize, wow, that was a good note. So I'll always tell you people that after you do your work, let other people see it. Listen to what they have to say. It's like a refrigerator. You open up the refrigerator, you look inside, and you decide what you want. You know, so much of the business, you're right, is ego, being in control. Everybody has to give their advice. Now, could you overly take people's advice and ruin your own story? Yes, you can. You listen to people's advice, you take their notes, and then in the end, you do what you want. Because Blake Edwards, the great director, told me once, he said, Chaz, it's better to die and fail with your own guns by your side than somebody else's guns. And he was right. Because if you fail doing it your way, you could always say, hey, I wanted it this way. I thought it was right. But if you fail doing somebody else's way, you could say, wow, maybe my way would have been right. So it's better, if you're going to fail, fail with your own way. Your own guns at your side. And if you're going to fail, fail doing something you love. Not something you hate. You know? People always say security, security. What's security? There is no security in the world. Policemen get fired. Sanitation men get fired. Lawyers get disbarred. They get fired. There's no security. The security is in with you. Is inside of you. If you believe in yourself, you keep on going. If you can't do it anymore, you do something else. Security. I used to hear that all the time when I was young. Get a city job. Get this job. No, no. From people. My mother, father always said, you have a dream, you believe it, you go do it. I mean, did I know all this was going to happen? Like I said, I believed in myself. I get on a plane now, right? I'm on a plane recently. And this happens quite often. And I'm sitting on a plane and they shut the door and they're getting ready to take off. And the pilot gets on the speaker and goes, ladies and gentlemen, yeah, he runs through his whole thing. And he says, and for one person sitting there and for all of you, I just have to say, the door is closed. Now you just can't leave. And I laugh, and the people who recognize me on the plane, we all laugh. And it's fun. It's fun to hear my lines in public, in the world. I'm walking down the street and somebody yells at me, hey, Chaz, put him in the bathroom. Hey, Chaz, now you just can't leave. Every time I walk into a restaurant, they shut the door and they go, hey, now you just can't leave. I mean, now you just can't leave probably is the biggest line from my movie, A Bronx Tale. But the funny thing of it is that we used real Hell's Angels in that scene. In that scene that you saw in Bronx Tale, those were real Hell's Angels. Our friend Chuck Zito, who was great, and obviously at that time he was a member of the Hell's Angels. He's not anymore, but at that time he was. In fact, he was the president of that chapter. He brought all these guys in, the real Hell's Angels. And I'll tell you a quick story about that. So we were doing the scene, And, you know, they weren't actors, but they were real. So Bob came over to me and whispered in my ear. He said, you know, let's do an improv. He says, really piss them off a little bit. Say something. Before we start the scene, you know, I'll run the camera, but really piss them off. I said, sure, okay. So I'm really good at improv, so we bam. Bob says, action. He says, but improv before you start the scene. So I start going off. You guys, who the fuck you think you are? You think you're tough guys? I said, how old are you guys? You're still riding motorcycles? I mean, I was like killing them. And I could see they were getting really pissed off, right? And I said, wow, this is going great. And then I said, you fucking Hell's Angels. And all of a sudden they all went, cut. The lead guy, Steve, went, cut. Wait a minute. Whoa, whoa, whoa. Stop the cameras, he's yelling. And I said, oh, shit. What the hell did I say, right? So he walks over to me and he says, hey, Chaz. This guy, Steve, he has the long red hair, and he passed away. He was in an accident, so God rest his soul. He was a hell of a nice man. And he said to me, Chaz, you can say anything you want to us, but you can't disrespect the patch. You can't say the name Hell's Angels. And when he said that, I understood that. And I said, absolutely, you're right. Even if it wasn't going to be on camera, it didn't matter. Because on camera, they were the Satan messengers. Satan messages, yes. So I understood that immediately, and I didn't do that anymore. But they were great. They were great in the movie. And that's a true story, you know. I mean, I was sitting at the bar when that really happened, when Sonny said to them, you know, when he was trying to be nice to them, he let them have their beer. And they actually, in the movie, they shook it and they sprayed it. In real life, what they did was they just held the bottle and they turned the bottle upside down, all of them, and they drenched the whole bar in the floor, and they all started laughing. And then Sonny walked over to him and he said, that wasn't very nice. And the lead guy said, in real life, you know, get the fuck out of here. This is our place now. We're taking over. And he just turned around, walked over, pulled the shade down at the door because the windows were blacked out already. I went, locked it, and went back to me and said, now you just can't leave. Whew. Now, I'm like 17. I'm sitting right near where the action's going on. Now you just can't leave. I'll never forget that because I'll never forget the look on their faces when he said that. You know, it's something when you see a tough guy, but it's another thing when you see a tough guy's face change. You see all their faces, I mean, this is right out of the play, dropped. All the strength and courage was drained from their bodies. You could see it in their eyes. They realized that fatal mistake. This time, they walked into the wrong bar. Man, wow. They came out of that room when Sonny called them, and he hit this guy with a right hand. They had bats and pistols and, wow. I mean, you're talking guys that spent time in Attica, Denamora, Sing Sing, some of his crew. You think these guys are afraid of anything? Anything? Nothing scares these guys. Nothing. These guys, that I would talk to them and they would tell me stories. He said, the only thing that I'm afraid of, one guy said who spent time in Attica, he said, the only thing that bothers me that I really can't stand is the smell. I go, what do you mean by the smell? And he said, all the fats that people laid all through the 40 years and 100 years that this prison's been here is inside the walls, Chaz. I don't know where I got off on that rant, but that's something I never told anybody. That was a rant that went off. I'll never forget that. And anyway, they beat these guys and pounce them. And don't forget, these guys, they're making like, then Sonny's paying them, what, $200 a week maybe each. They can't wait to show what they're made out of. They're, you know, if nothing happens for a long time, they get edgy. They want to fight. They can't wait to show Sonny, I'm going to show you that I'm worth that $200. They beat the living shit out of these guys. They hit them with bats and clubs and pistol whipped them. Then they broke their bikes. I mean, you know how these bikers feel about their bikes. Let me clarify. These were not the Hell's Angels. This was the crew that came, you know, when I was nine. Beat the living shit out of them. Broke their bites. It was a hell of a scene. And I would tell that story for years. I remember some of the bouncers who I worked with. I would tell this story when I worked the clubs, and they would just go, holy shit, what a story that is, Chaz. And when I wrote A Bronx Tale, I was able to put all these stories into this one-man show and tell it like I'm speaking to you right now. And there's so many stories that I'm going to tell, stories that did not make it into the movie, did not make it into the musical, did not make it into the one-man show. In fact, talking about, like, don't disrespect the patch, like he told me, Steve, I remember I came back, was 1994. I came back to the Bronx after, I think, this is after I got nominated for Academy Award for Bullets Over Broadway. So it was a big deal. I came back to the neighborhood. I saw all my friends. All my friends were on the corner. They were sitting there and standing there. I went over to them. I started talking. We started laughing, hugging, kissing. And there was one guy there who I won't say his name. But he just got made my friend. My close friend that I used to play basketball with just got made. And we were all talking, and for some reason he said something that was funny, but I thought it was wrong, and I turned and I said, oh, come on. Come on, what the fuck do you know? Stop it. And there was silence, and everybody looked at me, and I didn't understand why. Why are they all looking at me? And all of a sudden, he comes over to me, my friend, and says, Chaz, can I talk to you? I said, yeah. And he grabbed my elbow. They call that the elbow walk, you know. And he pushes me to the side and he says, you know what happened to me, right? And I said, what? I didn't understand what he was saying, to be honest with you. And he said, you know, the thing, you know, what happened to me. And then I realized what he was saying to me. That, don't you remember that we talked, that people told you that I got made? And I realized that, and I said, oh, yes, congratulations. And I hugged him, and I kissed him. And I said, I'm sorry, I should have congratulated you when I first saw you. And then he said to me, he said, you know, Chaz, you can't talk to me like that anymore. And I realized that he was right, because I said something in front of everybody, and it was wrong. And I apologized, and I said, I'm sorry. I said, I should have realized that. But, you know, I'm back here for the first time. You know, I'm sorry. And he said, I totally get it. I understand. Don't worry about it. I just, you know, want to straighten it out. I said, absolutely. And we hugged and kissed, and that was it. Well, being made is, he actually became a made guy. He was, you know, in the Cosa Nostra. And he couldn't be disrespected like that anymore. He couldn't, no one could talk to him like that anymore, especially in front of people. And I didn't realize that because obviously I wasn't around for a long time. You see, these people, they're like, this was my close friend that I played basketball with. And now I couldn't speak to him openly anymore. Is it much different than Hollywood? You know, I don't know, you know. It's very strange because when you have to edit yourself. My best friend in the whole world was who I grew up with. His name was Phil Foglia. Now Phil Foglia was he passed away because of COVID. And Phil Foglia is a man's man. Now, Phil knew this guy too. So it was strange when everybody was all together because Phil grew up in law enforcement. He was a lawyer. He was a DA. He worked with Rudy Giuliani. He was a believer in what's right. He was the most principled person I've ever met in my whole life. My best friend, Phil Foglia. And so when Phil was around and he was around this other guy, nobody could talk. If you said something, he looked at you. If you said another thing, he looked at you. So you couldn't really talk to each other. It was crazy. But we managed to do it. Because in my crew, there was wise guys, and there was cops, lawyers, but everybody always watched their P's and Q's about what to say. Because we all grew up together. It was very strange. But then as we got older, we really kind of drifted apart because we couldn't stay together anymore. So that was really interesting. But my friend Phil, who I talked about for a second, he was a man's man, like I said, and a guy who I'm just blessed that I had his friendship for, we were friends, met him at 9 years old, and we were friends for like 60 years. I mean, spoke every day on the phone. So I don't know if you ever had a friend like that where you just lose a close friend where kind of like a piece of you is gone. It's just gone. You don't know. Sometimes you walk around and you think you're going to call them on the phone and you can't. I don't know how I got off onto that, but I guess. Yeah. But, you know, and I always say, I was never a made guy. I was never even a wise guy. I never claimed to be a tough guy. I could handle myself well. My dad taught me how to fight. His father taught him how to fight. My father taught me how to box, and I teach my son how to box, and he will teach his son how to box. But as far as that goes, no. Was I enamored by them when I was young? Yes. Is Bronx Tale my story? Yes. My real name, Calogero? Yes. I used to throw the dice for the wise guys? Yes. Did I see a killing when I was 9 years old? Yes. Did I have a relationship with a black girl? Yes. Did my father drive a bus? Yes. A lot of those things are all true. And what you do is, as a writer, getting back to writing, you find incidences in your life that stand out, that are interesting, and you put them together and you could write some sort of story around them. My father and Sonny, I thought about putting my father here and Sonny here and the boy in the middle. I grew up with two sisters who are very successful. My sister Rose and my sister Mary, who are very successful. But I didn't put them in the movie because as a writer, I wanted it to be just an only child with Sonny on one side, the father on the other, and the boy in the middle trying to decide which is which. My sisters always kid around with me with that. Oh, yeah, with a family with no, sisters, you know. And I love them for that. But I couldn't put them in the movie, you know, or in the musical or the one-man show. But they know I love them. And they were very successful before their brother was.
And when you write those hit lines,
you know, when you're writing an iconic line, you don't know it's iconic. You know, you just write. If you start writing to think you want to write an iconic line or iconic scene, it will be bullshit because it's not real. I mean, who could write a line like that? Now you just can't leave. I mean, I don't know. I didn't think of that. Sonny said that. I didn't think of throw him in the bathroom. Now, he used to throw Eddie Mush in the bathroom. He didn't throw everybody in the bathroom. But as a writer, I embellished it. I threw everybody in the bathroom. But he only used to throw Eddie Mush in the bathroom. Now, a great story about Eddie Mush.
That was really Eddie Mush, right, in the movie?
That was really Eddie Mush in the movie. People go, well, who? That was Eddie Mush in the movie. In fact, the way we got Eddie Mush, we were trying to cast Eddie Mush in the movie. And Bob De Niro said to me, well, where's the real Eddie Mush, Chaz? And I said, well, Bob, he's up in the neighborhood. You know, he's probably about 65 now. I said, I forget, this is 30 years ago. I said, if he's anywhere, he's probably by the bookmakers. So we got in the car, and we drove up. We had a driver drive us up to the Bronx. And can you believe it? Who was sitting in front of the bookmakers with a racing form in his hand? Eddie Mush! I said, holy shit! I get out of the car. I said, Bob, wait here. I wasn't famous then, but obviously De Niro was. I get out of the car. I walk over to Eddie. I said, Eddie. He goes, hey, C, how you doing? He goes, hey, I hear you're making a movie about the neighborhood. I said, yeah. I said, oh, man, it's going to be great. I said, listen, I want you to come and read for it. But I want you to meet Robert De Niro. He goes, Robert De Niro? Where's he? I said, he's in the car. He goes, bullshit. He ain't in the car. I said, just come over to the car. And he says, no, I'm not going over to that car. He goes, hey, I owe too many people money. I'm not walking over to that car. He thought it was a hit. I mean, this guy's nuts, right? I say to him, please come over to the car. Bob De Niro's inside. I convince him to come over to the car. He comes over to the car, taps on the window. The power window goes down, you know, shh, it's Bob De Niro. He looks at Bob and goes, holy shit, it is you. Bob says, yeah. He said, listen, Eddie, I spoke to Chaz. I want you to come and read to play Eddie Mush. I want you to come and read for the part on Monday at 12 o'clock. Could you come Monday? This was a Saturday, I think I remember. And he goes, now picture this. Robert De Niro, the biggest star in the world, is telling you to come and audition for the movie. Okay? To audition for a movie. Eddie Mush goes, well, when do I have to go? He goes, Monday, 12 o'clock. Eddie Mush goes like this, Monday, 12 o'clock. He goes, could I come at 3? And I look at Bob, and Bob looks at me smiling. And I'm shaking my head like, can you believe this guy? And Bob says, yeah, come at 3. We can arrange it. Come at 3 o'clock. He goes, but not for nothing, Eddie. I'd just like to know, what are you doing that's so important at 12? You know, we just like to know. Eddie Mush goes, what am I doing? The Big A is opening. I got the Daily Double. I got to get there, Bob. I got some tips on a Daily Double at the Big A. The Big A was Aqueduct, the racetrack. We left. I get in the car, and Bob looks at me and goes, come on, Chaz. Who's better than that? That's Eddie Mush, because it is Eddie Mush. He goes, who could play somebody like that? I mean, that's the hard luck story of Eddie Mush. Eddie Mush never won a bet in his life. Eddie Mush would go to the bookmaker, make a bet, and everybody would wait to see who he bet, and then they would bet the opposite. It was getting so bad that the bookmakers stopped taking Eddie Mush's bet. He had to go to Brooklyn to make a bet because no bookmaker would take his bet because he would always lose, and the bookmakers would lose all the time.
What about the time when he convinced you to bet with him?
Oh, one time he convinced me to bet against the Knicks. He said Chamberlain was in the 76ers. Chamberlain's going to kill him. He's going to kill him. And I said, all right. I don't know what possessed me. I was like 14. So I bet against the Knicks. And we put on the TV in the club. And there was Will Chamberlain sitting on the sidelines with a suit on. And I said, he's not playing? What happened? And the announcer said, Will Chamberlain, in a freak accident, sprained his ankle on the basketball, and he'll be out for the game. So the Knicks destroyed the 76ers, and I lost the money. And my last thing about Eddie Mush, who I love, don't get me wrong, he never won a bet, but he was loved by the whole neighborhood. Great guy. When he passed away, Eddie Mush, we had the funeral at Mount Carmel Church. We bring in the casket out. The hearse had a flat. I've never seen that before. A flat on the hearse to put the casket in. They had to wait and bring another hearse so we could put the casket in a new hearse without a flat. Lucky the funeral parlor was right blocks away, so they just sent another hearse and we put the casket in that. A flat. And on his tombstone, it says, Eddie Mush Montanaro, the original Bronx Tale. Wow. That's Eddie Mush. I don't know, went on a rant with Eddie Mush, but there's so many great guys that I grew up in that neighborhood. My uncle Don Manfro. I mean, I used a lot of my uncle in that character of Sonny. The real Sonny was an incredible guy, But he's part of another personality that I gave him on my Uncle Don Manfro, who probably was one of the toughest guys I ever seen. I mean, my uncle, I'm telling you, my uncle, I never forget the front page of the Daily Mirror. It was in the Daily Mirror and the Daily News. The man got shot six times. He started running down the block. This guy pulled a gun on him, started shooting him, hit him with every bullet. And when he fell, this guy put the gun to his head and started pulling it again, and it was click, click, click. Ran out of bullets when he finally fell. And he went to the hospital, and I remember my father was so upset. My mother was so upset. I was so young, but I remember that. And we realized that he made it. He made it. Six shots, and he made it. And he was one of the toughest guys I've ever seen. I seen a kid pull a gun on him once at a nightclub, and the kid was freaking out. He goes, "I'll kill everybody here." And Manfro just walked right over to him, pulled the gun out of his hand, and said, "Hey, come here. Don't ever do that again in my joint." Do you imagine that? Walked over to him, pulled the gun out of his hand, and smacked him. And said, "Don't ever do that again in my joint." So getting back to the writing is writing about what you know. That'll really help you. Just like I did just now. Tell you these stories. A lot of these stories never made it into Bronx Tale. Never. But, you know, someday they'll make it into other movies and other things that I write about. And if you want to be a writer, write. Pick a time. Say, "I will write from 10 to 2 every day." And look at it like it's a job. And do it. Okay, even if you write one page a day, think about it. At the end of 3 months, you'll have a screenplay. Okay? If you write 3 pages a day, at the end of a month, you'll have a screenplay. Think about that. Writers write. Actors act. Directors direct. I know that sounds redundant, but it's true. If you want to be an actor, get out there and act. Nobody's going to knock on the door because they saw you in something. They have to see you do something. Direct and make friends with writers, actors. Network. Get your stuff out there so people could see. The biggest advice I could give you right now, the biggest advice that anybody could give you, and this is not my words. Woody Allen told me this. I said, "Woody, what's the secret to success?" He said, 85 to 90% of life is just showing up. Show up. If you show up, there's a chance something could happen. Okay? This is Chaz Palminteri on the Chaz Palminteri Podcast. God bless you all. See you next week.